So Paul is saying, conduct yourself with wisdom towards outsiders, making the most of the opportunity. Be smart. Keep your eyes open for opportunities and do the best you can with the opportunities that are given you. Then he says, let your speech always be with grace, seasoned as it were with salt, so that you know how to respond to each person. So he says, be smart, be nice, and then he says, be tactical.
5 centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Hey there, welcome to another edition of the White Horse Inn. I'm Shane Rosenthal. On the line with me as a guest we've had on the program numerous times before, Greg Kokol is the founder and president of Stand to Reason, and he also serves as an adjunct professor of Christian apologetics at Biola University. Greg is the author of a number of books, including The Story of Reality, Faith is Not Wishing, and Tactics, a Game Plan for Discussing Your Christian Convictions, which has just been released in a new 10th anniversary edition. Greg Kokol, thanks for joining us once again on the White Horse Inn.
Shane, it is so great to be back with you on the White Horse Inn. And by the way, how many years has the White Horse Inn been going?
This is now our 30th year anniversary. So you were back actually with us. If I recall, you were tagging along with us on our very first pilot episode.
Absolutely. I was right there at the inaugural launch. Yeah. And so we've got a 30-year relationship here, Shane, me and you and the rest of the crew. So it's a treat to be able to talk with you again today.
How did you and Mike Horton end up crossing paths? Was it actually after you first had him as a guest on your show on KBRT?
No. I think the way it happened is I was getting my master's degree in apologetics at Simon Greenleaf University.
Oh, that's right.
Kim Riddleberger was teaching there. And so I started hanging out with Kim outside of the class, and there was Mike. And so we would meet at Mike's house, you know, and I like to tell people that I cut my teeth on Reformed theology in Michael Horton's jacuzzi, which is true. And so that's how our relationship developed. It was in the early 90s, and he was the wunderkind, you know, or the reform movement at the time, Mr. Babyface, who knew all the right people and was making a great contribution early on. And it's just great to see what God has done through him and you and the White Horse Inn over the last 30 years.
You know, I have to say, as one of those fellow participants in the conversations in the jacuzzi, Michael Horton may have helped lead you to Reformed theology, but I think Mike and I learned a lot from you in those conversations, particularly in the gracious manner in which you've always navigated your way through conversations, along with what I would call a healthy dose of curiosity, which is something that you end up talking about in your book, Tactics.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that's a very high compliment coming from you, Shane. And it's nice to know that that I did have some impact there. And I do have a curiosity about a lot of things. And being careful about how we engage and being a diplomatic ambassador for Christ has been central to my approach. I'd say the last 30 years, I'm 46 years as a Christian, and the first 15 years or so, that wasn't the case. But I have mellowed out and seen not only the virtuous element of being gracious, but also the tactical value of being gracious. And so this is a big part of the tactical game plan that I teach on.
Go into that a little bit about mellowing out. What were those first 15 years like? What kind of mistakes did you make in those early days?
Well, I became a Christian in 1973, and very soon after that, I was a student at UCLA. I got involved with a Christian community right off the University of California, Los Angeles campus, and I was really a handful back then. I mean, I would be loud and aggressive and obnoxious, and there was one event that I was sharing Christ in love with, and I basically told a guy to go to hell at the top of my voice. Hmm. So, you know, I don't think that guy became a Christian, but this instruction that I got helped me to really formulate an attitude of generosity and grace and calmness. Now, of course, it took me a long time to work that out.
Right.
But once we started Stand to Reason about 27 years ago, I'd had a pretty good picture that I needed to work the shrillness out of my presentation. And I was on the road to do that. But I wanted to help other Christians also work the shrillness out of their presentation, their engagements as well, so that those engagements look more like diplomacy than D-Day, okay?
Right.
And that's just been a hallmark, I think, of Stand to Reason. And it's just sweet of you to mention that you recall that in our early times together way back in the early 90s.
Yeah. You know, Greg, one of the things I regret as I look back to the early days of my own conversion is that before I really even knew what I believed or why I believed it, I was quickly sent off to do street evangelism using a very basic follow these four steps kind of approach. But those sorts of programmatic approaches don't really work, do they?
Well, you know, maybe you and I have a little different view on this. I think there's an adjustment that needs to be made nowadays, and I'll tell you why. And this is really influenced, by the way, Shane, my whole tactical enterprise from the book. And in the second edition, I go into a lot more detail on this particular thing. Think about it. Jesus said in John chapter 4 that some sow and some reap. Now, he was just telling the disciples after he had talked to the woman at the well that they were about to reap where they did not sow. So in that short comment, he is identifying one field and two seasons, and the seasons are the sowing and the reaping. I call it gardening and harvesting, okay?
Yeah.
Before there can be a harvest, there's got to be a season of gardening, okay? Pretty straightforward. And also two types of workers, and those are gardeners and harvesters, or sowers and reapers. Now, the difficulty, I think, with the programmatic approach that you just identified is that it focuses largely on harvesting.
Yeah.
I mean, the idea was go through the steps, pray to receive Christ. And back then, lots of people did because of the unique circumstance in the culture, I think.
There was a lot of low-hanging fruit.
Yes, that's right. And exactly right. But times have changed. For one, back then people had a basic understanding of the general meanings of the words we used in a simple presentation of the gospel. People don't understand that anymore. You had much less hostility to those things than you do now. And so consequently, that approach now speaks language people don't understand, and it tries to harvest when the fruit is not ripe.
Yeah.
And so it seems to me the gardening period of time is much, much longer now than it ever was before. So I tell people, I'm a gardener. I'm not a harvester. I don't focus in on that. I don't worry about that. And most people are not ready for harvest. When they're ready, they get harvested easily. I want to encourage people with a game plan that will allow them to effectively garden in other people's lives, doing a little here, doing a little there, with tremendous protection, but great capability of making a difference in other people's lives. And that's the tactical game plan.
Yeah, and it's a wonderful book. What sort of things have you heard over and over again over the past decade from people who've read and profited from tactics?
I am so glad you asked that question, because, you know, you write different books and you're surrounded by writers, you know, who do well and everything. And people say nice things. Oh, I really liked your book, blah, 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 blah. But there is one phrase that I continually hear over and over. It's exactly the same phrase when I meet people at an event or something who've read the book and have employed the things in the book. In fact, I heard it just 3 days ago in Sanibel Island out by Fort Myers in Florida, where I was teaching. And what they say is, this book changed my life. This book changed my life. Now, that's obviously flattering, but it's not entirely surprising to me, Shane, because the things in this book changed my life too. And they changed my life in the way I engage. They changed in the, say, the comfort level with which I'm able to engage, even very hostile people. And it changed my life in the effect that I have, the ability to get people thinking about our convictions and their own convictions in a way that they never had before.
Mm-hmm.
Even the concept of gardening versus harvesting, you don't know how many people I have had come up to me after I give that portion of the presentation, and they say, you have set me free. Because they felt shackled by the idea that they've got to get to the gospel in every conversation, and they try to get the person to sign on the dotted line. And you know what they do? They don't do anything. They
Right.
sit on the bench because
Right.
it's too scary. And
Yeah.
so I have seen countless people get off the bench and get into the shallow end of the pool and start to make a difference in the lives of other people as they advance the gospel. It's been really great.
So what's new in this updated 10th anniversary edition?
Well, there's a lot of things that have changed. For one, I mean, just in word count, there's 40%+ new material. So wow. It's half again the a larger book than it was before. And I've doubled the number of tactics.
Wow.
So I have a whole chapter on a tactic called Inside Out. I have a chapter called Mini Tactics, and where I have three or four paragraphs to describe kind of small maneuvers that can easily be worked into conversations to help a lot. So there's a lot of new material.
So it sounds like if you already have the book, you still need to get the second edition.
That's what I'm working at here, because the first book is great. No complaints
right there.
But going through all of the chapters that were there in the first book, I realized that in 10 years of speaking on this to audiences, I've developed some new ways of talking about it that I thought were much more effective in the way I communicated how to do this well. And so I was able to pack a lot of new stuff in there on the chapters that already existed to make those chapters more robust, more clear, and more effective.
So now you just mentioned a new tactic called Inside Out. Give us a hint as to what that entails.
Well, the Inside Out tactic, I learned from Francis Schaeffer. He said, God exists, he made the world a certain way, and human beings are actually, in fact, made in the image of God. Okay?
Yeah.
So what this means is, we have reality on our side. That is, the Christian worldview, our explanation of the world, fits the way the world actually is. Not just the world writ large, but also the interior world of human nature
and
human understanding. So the basic concept to keep in mind in the Inside-Out tactic is we have inside information about what's inside of every human being. And that is something that God put there and always surfaces when people don't have their philosophical guard up, right? And they're not defending turf. So you take a guy like Richard Dawkins. He writes about morality, and he said, this kind of universe is exactly the kind of universe you'd expect if there is no God. There's no good, no bad. There's no design, no purpose, no good, no evil, just blind, pitiless indifference, okay?
But then he doesn't go on to live by those same assumptions.
That's exactly the point. The statement he made there is perfectly consistent with his atheistic, materialistic worldview. But then, and you're probably aware of the paragraph he has in The God Delusion, where he goes after the God of the Old Testament as this moral monster. But every single word in there is a moral judgment against God. Now, notice he's speaking out of two sides of his mouth. On the one hand, he's speaking from his atheistic materialism, a view that's completely consistent with it. And that is that there's no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. But then when he gets mad at God, now he's not, his guard is down, right? And he's raising his fist against God and basically saying that God is immoral. So given his worldview, where is he getting a standard of morality by which he's judging God? This isn't his materialism that's speaking. It is his common sense moral realism. Now, the point I'm making here is not that his assessment against God is accurate, but the kind of assessment he's making is at home in our worldview.
He's assuming certain things about the world that seem to match up with Christian theology.
Yeah, Frank Turek would call it stealing from God. And incidentally, this shows up in lots and lots of different ways. And so I might ask an atheist, would you ever try to talk somebody out of a suicide? Well, of course they would. And I say, why? Well, I don't want to waste their life. How can they waste their life if it has no meaning? They have no answer to that. Well, the meaning we give to life is the meaning that we give to it, and that's what makes life value. But the person who wants to commit suicide, the meaning that they're giving to it is nil, and that's why they want to die. So why are you messing with their life? The reason I ask these questions is to demonstrate that even the atheist intuitively knows that human beings are made for noble purposes. And that's why they'll say things like when a bunch of kids get killed in an auto accident, they refer to it as an untimely death, or they died before their time. Notice the teleology that's inherent in the statement, but a teleology that has no place in their worldview. So what I encourage people to do is listen to the other side. and listen for the times they make statements that they have no right to make, given their worldview, but really affirm our worldview, and with careful, gracious questions, point that out. That's basically the essential inside-out tactic.
Now, you note somewhere in your book that the word tactics literally means the art of arranging.
Right.
And since what you help your readers to arrange is their mental furniture, could one then argue that you're basically the feng shui master of Christian apologetics?
I never thought of it that way. and I don't even consider myself a master. You know, like someone once said that the coach is not the best player on the team. I make mistakes in this all the time, and I even talk about some big mistakes I've made. Just to encourage people that this whole thing is a process. Talking about spiritual things is messy business. You know, it just
is.
And it doesn't always go smoothly. And sometimes people get mad. Sometimes we get mad. And we just have grace towards ourselves and towards other people and do the best we can, because the Holy Spirit is the one who is going to take our imperfect offering and is going to do what he wants to do with it.
Yeah. Now, you write that the world has changed dramatically, and the basic theological concepts and the language we've used to convey them are largely unintelligible now to many in our culture, especially the emerging generation.
Mm-hmm. And it's pretty clear, even from the polling, that those who identify themselves as Christians, which is a very broad term, the vast majority do not have a Christian worldview at all. That is, they do not see reality through the lens of Scripture, through the understanding of the truth of Scripture.
Yeah, they say they follow Jesus, but, you know, they also believe in reincarnation. And
Yeah. Which Jesus do they have in mind? You know, Mormons believe in Jesus. Jehovah's Witnesses believe in Jesus. Muslims believe in Jesus, for goodness sake. And so, but they are completely different characterizations of Jesus of Nazareth than the Gospels characterize him as. So we have a tough challenge ahead of us. And this is why I keep coming back to this. When you enter into a conversation of some sort where it starts to have spiritual substance to it, I do not want you thinking about leading that person to Christ. Forget about it. I don't want it on the radar. That's like going into the Super Bowl and thinking about what the last play is going to be at the end of the game. If you're focusing on the last play, you can't give proper attention to the first play right in front of you. And so what I tell people to do is do not think about anything but one thing at first, and that is to gather information. Get a lay of the land. Find out what the other person believes. Make them go into some detail about it. The more they talk, the better, because now you have a better picture of what you're up against. And you might decide that there's no opportunity here. Fine. You haven't lost anything. You've gotten a little bit of an education.
Last time we had you on, you talked about this, and you had an anecdote about a friend who was talking with a Buddhist, and they asked you for a book on Buddhism.
Yes.
And you recommended that he just have a conversation with
That's right.
Ask him what he believes. Because a lot of times people believe in their own brand. It's kind of a cafeteria Buddhism. It's, you know, a little
That's
bit of this, a little bit of that, a little bit of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
So you really need to learn to lean into what your conversation partner, your friend, your coworker believes, because often it's not something that you will find on a bookshelf.
That's right. Absolutely. This cafeteria approach to religion is uniquely Western, and especially American. And so that's the problem you run into. You buy a book on Buddhism, it's not the Buddhism of the person that you're talking to, especially if they're an American. Now, rather, as you pointed out, I suggested just take them out to, you know, for coffee or something and say, hey, I understand you're a Buddhist. I don't know anything about Buddhism. I'm a Christian. Tell me about Buddhism. And now you're going to have the other person happily explain their point of view in a relaxed, genial environment where you're both having coffee or lattes or whatever, and you're going to get a free education while you build a relationship with the very person that you want to have eventually a salutary impact on for Christ. It's so easy when you follow these steps, and it's amazing the impact that those steps will have on other people, even when you don't get into a lot of detail about the gospel.
And so what the person needs to do in that conversation, initially anyway, is to hold off on making any kind of criticism, but be a good listener and ask follow-up questions about what they believe, but why do they believe it?
Yes.
And you're treating the person with respect.
That's right. You just mentioned the second step. The first step is to gather information about what they believe, basically. And we use some variation of the question, what do you mean by that? You're just drawing them out. And the second step is to, I call it reversing the burden of proof. And that's just, since they're making a claim about what they believe, we want to know why they believe it. What are your reasons for it? Now, any Christian, Shane, can ask those two questions. What do you mean by that? How did you come to that conclusion? Any
right.
Christian, a Christian who is one day old, you don't need to know any theology, no apologetics, no philosophy, straight ahead. You're just a student there of the other person's views. But I'll tell you a secret. It's absolutely amazing when you ask somebody who is holding an alternative view and has expressed it in some minimal form, when you ask them to explain it further, what do you mean by that? Help me out. Help me to understand. Okay. Or you ask them for their reasons for the view they've just explained that they hold. And oftentimes you get dead air. It's amazing, but it's an opportunity for them to realize that maybe they haven't really thought through their issue very much, or maybe they don't have really good reasons for their view. And by the way, these are questions that are almost never asked of other people.
Yeah, because, you know, as we mentioned, it's kind of a cafeteria world. We kind of identify ourselves in the West more than anything as consumers. So I am the sum of my choices. That's why, you know, even sexual identity is on the radar now, because I think of myself more as a consumer than anything else, and I'm just going to be what I want to be. And as a result of that, you know, when it comes to worldview issues, I just kind of buy into these catchphrases that sort of tickle my ear. George Orwell, in a 1946 essay called The Politics of the English Language, he warned people about, you know, these ready-made phrases that end up thinking your thoughts for you.
Yes.
You write something similar in your book where you talk about whether Christian or secular, this is not just a problem out there, they just recite these slogans or catchphrases without thinking about them.
Go into that a little bit. No, this is a great observation, Shane. And I wasn't aware of that particular quote from Orwell, but many people are aware of the adjective Orwellian. And he is talking about the manipulation of language. I mean, famously, The Final Solution. That sounds like something good. And that was the phrase that was used to describe the plan to exterminate all the Jews in Europe. And so this goes on all the time. Sloganizing, using the slogans to make progress or to silence the opposition without any deep understanding of what the slogan means. And I think the other side uses slogans in that way more often, but Christians use slogans in a different way frequently, and that is to try to, in a sense, showcase their own view in a way that turns out to be rather ambiguous. Jesus died for your sins. They don't communicate to the other person the substance of what's going on. They think,
particularly if they don't know what sin means.
Yes, yes, exactly.
I actually had a conversation with someone who told me that his non-Christian coworker that he was talking with actually stopped him as they were discussing spiritual issues and said, wait, you just used the word sin. The only time I've ever really seen that word used is on a dessert menu.
That's an amazing. Pleasure, yes.
Exactly.
That's
sinfully delicious.
Now, I didn't realize it was quite that bad, you know, but I'm an old guy, so I'm not as in touch with the, you know, the popular culture as some others. But this is one of the reasons, and by the way, I talk about this as a mini tactic. The tactic is called watch your language. Watch the words that you're using, like sin or salvation or blood of Jesus or any of these other things, Trinity, a whole host of theological things that have some meaning to Christians but are nothing more than Christian noise to non-Christians.
Instead, it's jargon that's not explained.
Exactly. This is why I don't talk about people getting saved. I talk about getting rescued, okay? It's got a different sense. I don't talk about sin. I talk about rebellion against our sovereign.
You don't even talk about the word faith. You talk about trust.
That's right. There's another one, because the word faith has been so corrupted in the English language for any usefulness. I think just get rid of it. I don't want you to have faith in Jesus. I want you to put your trust in Jesus and follow him. Now, it's the same thing in terms of substance, but when you use those words, it has an entirely different impact in communication.
I totally agree. Now, in his books on the emerging generation, Christian Smith talks a lot about the relativistic assumptions that are sort of baked into the views of younger people today. And one of the implications of this pervasive relativism seems to be that people don't really care what other people believe because it's all good. And because you have your truth and I have my truth, what you often get is a kind of passive shrug in which nothing really matters other than scrolling through my social media channels. How do you think we should deal with this particular challenge?
Well, this is kind of an apathetic response that I get questions about all the time. And I do think it's one of the hardest things to deal with. Now, by the way, I think people talk relativistically all the time, but I don't think deep down inside they are genuine relativists. I think they're common sense realists. And again, their language is going to give them away. But there is this sense of people don't, like you said, I don't care what other people believe. Unless what other people believe is vocally contrary to what they believe, and then they argue forcibly that they are right, at least in having the liberty to call their view moral, and you are wrong in calling their view or their conduct immoral. But how do you deal with the apathy? And this is where I think the tactical approach is kind of the only hope, because you can't preach to a person like this. Because they don't want to be preached at. Just like you said, well, I don't care what you believe. You can believe what you want. Just don't force your morality on me. And that's kind of their concern. When you do, then they got something to say about it. Okay, so how do you deal with that person? One of the questions that you can ask them is this. I'm just curious, and I don't know. I'm trying to find other people's opinion about this and wonder what you think. You mind if I ask you a question? No, go ahead. What do you think happens when you die? What do you think? It is a genuine question to get another person's point of view. Now, somebody might say, you know what, I don't know, nothing happens, I don't know, and I don't care. Okay, well, then you just let the conversation die a natural death, in my view. But what you've done is at least taken another step to try to move the conversation forward with a person that has already expressed apathy. Maybe you're going to get a response. Now, if a person gives you a response, that is, they tell you something they think happens after you die, and maybe the something is nothing, this is an opportunity to ask the second question, why is it that you think that's what happens?
Particularly now, in light of the fact that there are many other answers to that question.
Well, there are lots of answers. This person has one answer that they think they believe something. Of course, they must have a reason for why they believe it. If a person doesn't totally shut you down with the first question, this is another question that you could advance, again, without sounding pushy or aggressive, and see what they say. That is the best advice that I have for dealing with an apathetic person. And I don't know any other advice that's going to make a difference. You must ask a question, because then they either ignore you, okay, or they answer. And I think most people are inclined to at least answer in some way a polite question, and that may give you a little toehold in the conversation.
Yeah, so part of your goal then is to be curious, to lean in and to listen, and then also to graciously help others to see the logical consequences of their convictions.
That's right. In fact, helping them see the logical consequences of their conviction is a specific tactic, and it's called taking the roof off. It's a kind of reductio ad absurdum. You reduce the view to the absurd consequences that lead from the view. And that is a very effective way of trying to make a point, but you always use questions in the process.
One of the passages you frequently cite is Colossians 4, verses 5 and 6. Can you talk about that text and its implications for us, particularly in the way we talk with outsiders?
Yeah, it's a great little text from Paul. And he starts out by saying, conduct yourself with wisdom towards outsiders, making the most of the opportunity. Okay, this is a good start. So Paul is saying, be smart. Keep your eyes open for opportunities and do the best you can with the opportunities that are given you. Okay, that's good. So first, be smart. Then he says, let your speech always be with grace, seasoned as it were with salt. All right. So first he says, be smart. Then he says, be nice. What a concept, you know? And then he says, so that you know how to respond to each person. So he says, be smart, be nice, and then he says be tactical. And the cookie-cutter approaches that you described earlier, these pragmatic approaches, the four steps to peace with God kind of thing, that may not speak to the need of the individual you are
right.
speaking with at the moment, which is the encouragement or exhortation of Paul in Colossians 4, verse 5 and 6. So how do you do that? They're strangers. You just met them. You don't know much about them. Right. That's why you ask questions. That's why you ask them about what they believe, about what their convictions are. And I want to encourage your listeners too, Shane, especially younger ones feeling more timid. In my view, you have no obligation to go any further than just gathering information. I'm not pressuring anybody. Just do the first thing. I was in Paraguay this summer, and on my way back, I stopped over in Brazil. It was a stopover in the airplane, middle of the night, almost nobody there. And I ended up sitting at a table with an LDS guy, a Mormon missionary. And I thought to myself, man, I've been working for the last 10 days really hard, and now I'm in the middle of the night on a 20-hour flight or something. I don't want to talk about Jesus, you know. I don't want to get into a head-to-head. I mean, quite frankly, that was my view. Then I took counsel from my own advice. I said, you don't have to go bang heads with this guy. All you got to do is ask him some questions about his view. That's all you do.
Yeah.
And so realizing that, I relaxed, and I just asked some questions for the sake of me gaining some more information about his view, with no commitment on my part to go the distance with him. What's going to happen with a lot of people is you're going to end up comfortably going further if you get started. But you don't have
right.
to worry about going further. Just get started. And if it goes no further, no problem. There's no pressure in this approach. I don't want you to swing for the fences, all right, to use a baseball analogy. I don't even want you to get on base. I just want you to get in the batter's box and then see what the Holy Spirit will do.
You call it the ambassador model, and you say that that trades on a friendly curiosity, a kind of relaxed diplomacy,
right.
rather than on confrontation. I think that part's really important for us to recover in our own day, because everywhere we turn, we see bomb throwing.
Yeah.
You know, whether you're looking at cable news where people are vomiting their opinions on someone from the other side of the political fence, or whether we see Uncle Bob's rant on Facebook.
Right.
You're arguing that we should have a relaxed diplomacy, but we don't really see a lot of that out there in the world. So who is mentoring us
yeah.
to do that?
I can think of one public voice that is like that, and this one you're probably familiar with in your listeners, is Dennis Prager.
Yeah.
But frankly, yeah. most are not like that. And I recommend people listen to him just to learn how to navigate well and graciously in conversations. Actually, tomorrow I'm doing a PragerU. I'm filming a PragerU tomorrow.
Oh, cool. Well, on what topic?
Well, the topic is tolerance, and the title of this piece is called The Intolerance of Tolerance. And the substance of it is basically that what used to be called tolerance is really now intolerance, viewed as
yeah.
intolerance, and what used to be called intolerance is now being viewed as tolerance. It's a shell game that's being played, and a lot of people don't know what's happening, and they are caught by surprise. So in this PragerU, and by the way, that's P-R-A-G-E-R and the letter U, Dennis Prager University kind of thing. It's a series of short videos. They are like 300 of these you can find in the internet.
Yeah, they're great.
That promote not only conservative causes, but religious concerns. And so I get to do this one on the concept of tolerance. And it's something I've written about and something I've spoken on. And so what I do in this 5-minute video is I uncover the shell game. I show what's going on. And then I reacquaint the viewers with the classical view of tolerance. And the classical view isn't that every view has equal value. It's that every human being has equal value. And
yeah.
views could be right or wrong, true or false, or even dangerous. And so we ought to have the liberty in our conversations to figure out which is which instead of being called names because we hold politically incorrect views.
When will that be available? Like toward the end of the month?
I'm not sure. But that particular platform gets 1 billion views a year.
That's crazy.
So these guys really move the meter, and I'm glad to make my contribution.
You know, one of the points that Dennis Prager has made over the years is that clarity is more important than agreement. And that's part of what you're saying
that's
is you
right.
have to understand the other side. First, get clarity in the question-asking stage.
Yeah. Clarity before agreement is his approach. And I try to mm-hmm. do that as well. When you look at the way most people confront, and I think Christians have picked this up as well in their conversations, because this is what's modeled to them, even with other Christians, is these conversations become gladiator events. That is, it's like, okay, we're going to spar hard and draw blood, and the one who draws the most blood wins.
Yeah.
But that ought not be a Christian spirit. And by the way, all the rest of us listening and watching that, we're thinking, I can't do that. I'm not quick on my feet. I can't deal with that guy that way. I can't win before everybody else, so I'm not even going to try. And
yeah.
that's the huge problem. We're not getting into play because we have in our mind a model of what that looks like that we are not up to. And as you pointed out, that model is not virtuous anyway.
Yeah. So your goal is just to get into the batter's box, ask some questions. Maybe the responses to those questions won't even occur to you until a week later. If
that's
you have
right.
a relationship with a person, you can ask a follow-up a week later. But the point is to get into the batter's box. And the way you put it is to put a stone in someone's shoe
right.
to give them something to think about that they may not have thought of before.
That's right. Absolutely. And so your listeners know, those who have read the first book know this, but some may not realize, I walk them through step by step. I hold their hand. I show them this is doable. You can do this. You can make a difference. It doesn't matter how shy you are. Doesn't matter how timid you are. Doesn't matter how little you know about theology or philosophy or apologetics. If you know more, that's to your advantage. But you don't need to know all of those things to begin gardening and
exactly.
gardening effectively.
And the process of just asking questions may be some gardening for you as well, because you're learning something about your conversation partner, whether they be Roman Catholic, Hindu, secular, whatever.
Yeah. I encourage people to think of it precisely that way when they're using the first two steps of the game plan, finding out a person's view and then finding the reasons for their view. I encourage them to just consider themselves students.
Yeah.
They don't have to be the lecturer, the teacher, the professor, telling other people what's right and wrong. I mean, there's a place for that, and you want to get around to that, but you want to do that shrewdly. But these first two steps, you want to be a student of other people's views. And I'll tell you what's going to happen, Shane, if they just commit themselves to doing that and that alone. Never mind getting to the end game. You just try to be a student of other people's views by asking what they mean and why they believe it's true. You're going to learn two things, and this is what others have told me as well. You're going to first learn that other people are not as frightening as you thought. That is the opposition.
Right.
Now, you realize they're human beings like anybody else, so they're not as scary. That's the first thing you learn when you converse, asking these questions. Here's the second thing they're going to learn, and you can take this to the bank. They're not as smart as you think, too. I don't mean that they're stupid, but it is axiomatic that people who are very bright make very simple mistakes in thinking when it comes to spiritual things.
Yeah, because Paul says people suppress the truth and unrighteousness. So, and
you
have some of that inside out information that they do that, and
That's
it comes
right.
out in various parts in the conversation.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah.
Now, over the past 10 years, has it ever happened to you where you're having a conversation with someone and you're doing some question gathering that someone puts a stone in your shoe?
Well, yeah, that happens, of course. And this is exactly what the atheist is trying to do, especially ones that are trained like Peter Boghossian, the atheist at Portland State University, has written a book. Look over my shoulder to see the title of it in my bookshelf. I think it's called A Handbook for Creating Atheists. Oh, it's called A Manual for Creating Atheists. I'm looking at it right now. And what he does is he teaches atheists to make other atheists by doing the same thing that I'm saying Christians should be doing.
Hmm.
They don't argue. They ask questions, and the goal is to put a seed of doubt in the Christian, especially with regards to the role of faith in their life, that is blind faith. And he's very effective with this approach that they call street epistemology. So atheists and non-believers are trying to do this all the time. Well, what about this? Well, what about that? They're firing these things off to the Christian, and the Christian doesn't know how to respond. What happens in the heart of the Christian? There's this little cold chill goes up the back of their spine, and I've experienced this too. And what that chill means is you're thinking, gosh, that's a good point. I don't know how to answer it. Maybe he's right and I'm wrong. And that scares us, okay? So what I suggest in the tactics book, when you run into somebody with whose objections that you cannot deal with, and you're in the hot seat there, you more aggressively take the student role and you say, okay, slow down a little bit. These are things I haven't thought about, and I really want to understand your view. Tell me what you believe and why you believe it, and let me think about it. So you're already admitting that you can't answer it. You're going to get the education. And then on your own, at your leisure, when the pressure is off, that's when you try to find an answer.
Yeah. I actually think it's helpful at that point to ask your conversation partner, you know, what books would you recommend for me to study that further? Again, it's leaning in and it's showing you're curious, but also showing that you're taking their views seriously, you know?
Yeah, that's a great recommendation. And then later on, that's when you can come back to White Horse Inn or str.org for Stand to Reason or any of your other books or your counselors in these kinds of things and find the answers to the challenge and maybe develop some questions that you can use to employ those answers next time you're at that spot in a conversation with somebody
else. Yeah, and that's when it becomes really meaningful. You know, you can have a stack of apologetic books with a lot of facts about how do you answer this objection and that. But, you know, sometimes that can be dry reading unless there's someone in your life who's asking those questions. When you have a person in your life who's asking those tough questions,
that changes
then
everything.
You go looking for the answers, that's when you remember it well.
That's exactly right. When you're just reading the stuff, it's kind of academic. It's not until you get into a discussion does the content become really important. But then you have to find a way to bridge from what you know into the conversation that is productive. And that's where the tactical game plan comes in.
Before we let you go, one of the other texts that you bring up a lot is 2 Timothy 2:24. You know, Paul writes to Timothy saying that the Lord's servant shouldn't be quarrelsome, but kind to everyone. And that he should correct his opponents with gentleness. And then he says that God may perhaps grant them repentance. What do you think are the implications of what Paul's saying there?
There's a couple of different places in the New Testament where it makes it clear that we are to be gracious and gentle and not, you know, looking for a fight when we engage other people. Okay, and I mentioned one out of Colossians, there's one in 1 Peter chapter 3, and there's this one here in 2 Timothy chapter 2. The thing that I like about this particular passage is it seamlessly connects the duties that we have as followers of Christ to communicate in a gracious way, to defend the faith and answer, but with grace and respect. It connects that to the sovereign purposes of God to make the difference in the life of the individual you're talking to. Because it shows, okay, we got a job to do, but ultimately it's our task to engage in a particular way, but it is God's problem to make the difference in that person's life. We just have to worry about being faithful on our side and the sovereign purposes of God get worked out. This is where we get right back to the gardening thing. You know, if we do our gardening well, then God worries about the harvest. And look, when the harvest is necessary or ready, then God's going to bring a harvester to help gather that, as you put it, low-hanging fruit. We don't have to worry about that. Let's get out and do some gardening, a little here, a little there. Paul plants, Apollos waters. God causes the increase.
God gives the growth. Yeah, exactly. Well, one last thing. You say that we need to cultivate the ability to disagree with civility and not to take opposition personally.
Yeah.
So how do we go about doing that? How would you counsel someone listening to this program who just always seems to get really nervous when talking about spiritual issues and who does end up taking things personally?
Yeah, I think the problem here is not so much the nervousness, but the compulsion to get hostile. And
But sometimes those are related, right?
Yeah. Both. If you're nervous, then you're defensive about your own views. And so when somebody takes exception with you, especially if they bring up something you can't deal with, then you respond with hostility, you know, and you figure you got a weak point, so you pound the podium, you know, kind of deal. I wish I had like a real simple RX for this. I'm looking at my own life. The way I got nicer is by being intentional about it, okay, and telling myself, okay, don't answer back, don't get defensive, bite your tongue, you know, and let someone finish what they're saying and think about it. It's like any other virtue. These things don't happen overnight. Usually, these are things that we, with our trust in God, we give ourselves to develop. We give attention to develop in time. And so after a rough road of a lot of failures, little by little, we get better at it. And the more confident we get in our own view, Shane, the more confident that we are that Christianity is actually true, and this would be the function of more apologetics in our life, then the less likely we are to be defensive, I think.
Right.
And the more often we can do something that I suggest on occasion is to let the other person have the last word.
Yeah.
That's virtuous. It's nice to them. But it also, since you're willing to give them the last word, it conveys a tremendous sense of confidence in your own view.
Well, you've been hearing from Greg Kokel, founder and president of Stand to Reason and the author of Tactics, which has now come out in a new updated edition. You can find information about Greg's book and all that he does at Stand to Reason, STR.org. Greg Kokel, thanks for being my guest today on the White Horse Inn and for writing this really helpful book.
Oh, what a treat, Shane. Hey, say hi to the boys for me, okay?
Will do. The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. For more information about this program, visit us online at whitehorseinn.org. If you sign up as an innkeeper, architect, or reformer, not only will you get a complimentary subscription to our magazine, Modern Reformation, but you'll also get longer editions of every White Horse Inn broadcast. To find out how to join one of these support programs, click on the support tab of our website, whitehorseinn.org. You can also give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. We'll see you next time at the White Horse Inn.